It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. If you really love what you do outdoors, it's natural to want to document that with pictures or video, and as a viewer, to want to watch the very best. Skiing films have been around forever, and you can see some impossible-seeming stuff. But today, all kinds of outdoor filmmaking is exploding. Young people have equipment that is much less expensive than it used to be. There are easy avenues to get film seen, and adventurers and athletes are doing spectacular feats that are exhilarating to watch. On today's show, we're talking with an accomplished adventure filmmaker and a young Alaskan filmmaker who is already showing great promise, and I'm hoping to hear them swap stories and tips and maybe get some ideas for how you can make your own video look better if you're out making films of what you're doing. So the guests I have with me today are both on the phone, one from Washington and one from British Columbia. Max Romney is in school down in Washington. He's an Alaskan filmmaker who is working on a film about the Mount Marathon race and just kind of getting started in this whole thing. Thanks for being with us, Max.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
And Brian Smith is a pretty famous filmmaker who has done some extraordinary stuff. He was in Anchorage last month presenting at the Atwood Concert Hall with the with his National Geographic work that he has done. I'm sure a lot of people went out and saw that, and we've got some links to some of his extraordinary film that you can see. Brian Smith is with us from British Columbia. Thanks for being with us, Brian.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I was interested in watching one of your films talking about how you got into being an adventure filmmaker, that it started with the adventure, not with the filmmaking, and you sort of began like a lot of guys do. They're doing cool stuff, and they want to make a film of it, and it sort of grew from there.
Yeah, I think early on I realized that, you know, if you want to be a filmmaker, you got to kind of figure out what your path is and what sort of separates you from the pack. And what I had at the time was I had skills to get down rivers and get up mountains. And so I thought, well, you know, that's a skill set that a lot of filmmakers actually don't have. So, you know, maybe I'll try to apply that skill set and just, you know, take on this idea of if you can get cameras into difficult locations, you can bring back, you know, unique images.
Yeah, and some of your films, it's almost like as a viewer, you're enjoying what you're watching, but you're also got going through your mind, like, how did they do this, right? Like, how did they get equipment out into this situation? And so you must have developed some pretty unique skills in that direction as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing, if you're kind of wondering, like, well, how did they get a camera there? There's not really usually an easy solution. Other than to be able to, you know, exist in that environment. So, you know, whether it's hanging off a rope, you know, filming climbing or paddling down a river, you know, typically in a lot of the films that we're making, we're working, you know, almost equally as hard as the athletes to try to exist in the environment that we're operating in.
Right, and you mentioned in this film that is on your website that you've got this very expensive equipment, and I think we all, when we take good cameras out on trips, we think about how are we going to keep that camera safe, and you sort of say, well, you can't keep it safe. You just have to sort of realize you're going to try to keep it in good shape, but in a lot of situations, it's just like, hopefully it's okay, and it might not be.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we obviously, like, you know, in your expedition filmmaking, like, your camera, you know, keeping that camera alive is essential to capturing the story, so you know, you do want to take some care of it, but, you know, I think we spend a lot of time figuring out, you know, what cameras and what sort of equipment works in really, you know, sort of hard environments, because the thing is if it's beautiful and sunny out and that's the only time you pull your camera out, you're probably not going to actually capture the story that you want. And, you know, when you're filming in sort of outdoors environments, some of the best footage comes when the weather's the worst, you know, like storms and rain and snow and you know, I think pretty early on I realized, well, if you're not going to pull your camera out and use it, then what's the point of having it there? So yeah, I mean, it's a balance between, you know, you don't want to kill the thing because then you have no tool to work with, but at the same time, you know, modern technology is allowing us to, you know, have some pretty robust pieces of equipment, and I think a lot of times people are just, you know, scared to bring their fancy camera out or scared to film, but we kind of flipped that on its head and went, well, if you pull it out and you get these shots that people wouldn't otherwise expect, then typically those are the moments that people remember.
Right. That's what it was for in the first place. Yeah. So for people who don't know about your work and about your relationship with National Geographic, tell us about what you're doing now and sort of how you finance what you do. And I've seen some of your pretty amazing film of kayaking. Give us a little bit of thumbnail sketch of Brian Smith.
Well, I mean, I started off in making kayaking films because that was what I knew the most. It was my backyard, so to speak. And then eventually that kind of migrated into all kinds of adventure work. And I landed a really cool job with National Geographic for a television show called Nat Geo Amazing. And then, you know, things kind of exploded from there. I've done all kinds of stuff for them, you know, everything from adventure stuff to reality TV. I spent 4 months actually up in Alaska as the director of photography for Alaska Wingman. So I've had a really kind of diverse career, so to speak, with National Geographic. And, you know, now we're in a position where we often do some short films that we self-finance and just, you know, go out and do, and oftentimes get smaller sponsors like outdoor industry affiliates, you know, companies like Arc'teryx, Patagonia, people that are invested, you know, pretty closely in the outdoor community. But then a lot of the bigger projects we do, one-hour documentaries or series-driven stuff, you know, we definitely go to big clients, the National Geographics, Red Bulls, the people that, you know, are kind of in the driver's seat of producing and funding a lot of, you know, bigger, longer-form content. So, you know, the disadvantage there is obviously it's not really ours. you know, it's National Geographic or Red Bulls or whoever we're working for. But the advantage is that, you know, oftentimes to produce these bigger, high production value, longer format shows, you need cash flow. I mean, you need a big chunk of money to go out there and do it. And those are, you know, hard projects to self-finance.
Yeah, really. So, but tell me about the passion behind this. I mean, what drives you in terms of wanting to do this kind of work?
I think, you know, the passion, passion is largely what's gotten me where I am, I think, because, you know, sure, it's a job and work and, you know, I make a living, but, you know, this is what I love to do. And I think the passion really started and still is to try to share with people the places and the experiences that I've always, you know, gotten a lot of joy and happiness out of, you know, being outside and feeling alive and, you know, just capturing that spirit of adventure and exploration. So, I mean, that's really, you know, where the passion started, and it still is today. I mean, I live vicariously through a lot of the athletes that we work with because they're just amazing human beings that are doing incredible things, and it's fun to share that with bigger audiences.
Yeah. Well, I noticed a lot of smiles on the faces of the film I was watching, and that sort of translated that feeling that was going on more than just the incredible stuff people are doing, but sort of the feeling of camaraderie and people out there. And I want to bring in Max Romney. Max, you were saying that you had admired Brian's work over the years, and it sounds like kind of Brian is who you want to be in a few years, yes?
Yeah, no, you basically nailed it. I mean, I grew up watching stuff like, you know, Nat Geo Adventure and Amazing and stuff like that. And I'm not a climber, but after I watched, you know, his free soloing videos or the kayaking videos, I'm just ready to like plunge into that. You know, it's like he's just sharing liquid inspiration. It's wonderful.
Yeah, that's right. No, and I've had, you know, when I've had my kids at home, and I want to go skiing. And they're saying, oh, I want to hang out with my friends. I want to stay in town. You just, like, go on the computer and start bringing up some skiing videos. And, like, 10 minutes later, everybody's ready to go. It's all about that inspiration and sort of bringing that spirit to you, right?
Oh, yeah, it's right in there. And I'm not working with, you know, the intense sports so much. I'm working with some pretty crazy stuff, a lot of this mountain running, which Alaskans really embody more than anybody I've ever met. And it's not, you know, quite as intense as skiing or climbing or kayaking, but it feels just as intense. And I'm working really hard to try to capture that feeling and that kind of inspiration that comes from it and share it, which I find is pretty tough because, you know, you've got to find the angles, but just as fulfilling.
Well, I have to tell folks that the reason we're doing today's show is because Holly Brooks, who is, of course, a huge hero to Alaskans as an Olympic cross-country skier and as a mountain runner, contacted me to tell me about a film that Max is working on making about the Mount Marathon race. And so I watched a trailer, which I guess was on your fundraising site. Is it on your? Is it still available on your site now, Max, that trailer?
Yeah. So you're able to find most stuff on 3022feet.com.
Yeah, and so that's all going to be linked at our Outdoors at our site, alaskapublic.org, and just check out the outdoor filmmaking link on that on our page, and then you'll find Max's stuff and Brian's stuff. In any event, I watched this and I thought, wow, that is really exciting. That really made me want to be involved in Mount Marathon. It really made me want to go up there, and it was very inspiring, just like you're talking about Brian's work. And so I thought, this kid has a lot of talent. Let's get him on the radio and find out, talk to somebody about who's just starting out. And so tell me about your project. I mean, what are you trying to accomplish with this film about Mount Marathon?
Yeah, well, so basically, Mount Marathon is this race in Seward on the 4th of July. It's, I bet a lot of Alaskans know the details, but it's 3 miles up and down this big old cliff of a mountain called Mount Marathon, 3,022 feet of elevation total. And it's this very popular, it's one of the most popular mountain races in Alaska. And I had always heard about it, and I was kind of wondering, you know, what the big hype is about. So a couple of years I went down to the camera. The race absolutely blew my mind. I couldn't believe people were doing this. And, I'm a runner, and I couldn't, you know, fathom doing this. And so the year after, I returned with the idea of, I'm going to capture this race like nobody's captured it before. I'm going to get cameras all over the mountain. I'm going to try to get those angles that make you feel like you're there. Because not everybody can be on the mountain. Even though there's 40,000 people in Seward, very few people actually get a taste of what the race is actually like. And it's so hard to describe. You can only really capture it. And so we got there weeks before. Filmed a lot of the athletes beforehand. During the race, we actually had about 17 cameras on the mountain and really tried to catch this race, catch the element of this race. And I think we did an excellent job of capturing all the footage. So now we've got about 100 hours of footage, over a terabyte worth of film, and we're editing it down into a movie with the idea of trying to kind of share it through film festivals and local screenings and really bring the passion of mountain running all over the place.
Yeah, and I have to admit that I've been following this race pretty much my entire life, and the images that you captured were really surprising to me. I didn't know it was going to that it looked like that up there, and that sort of the kind of crazy angles and the, you know, the sort of part of that, you know, I always knew it was scary, but once you see it on film, it's even more scary. And then you also capture, like Brian was talking about, it's just sort of the emotions of the people involved, which I thought was really impressive.
Yeah, you really, I mean, even though I've worked really hard to get a lot of these angles, I'm never going to be able to truly capture the experience of falling down a mountain like these people do, in the same way that I doubt a lot of these adventure sports ever truly capture the experience, but we're getting really close by going kind of out on a limb. I know Brian's had to do a lot of crazy cable cam stuff and climb up all these mountains. For me, it was basically just getting the right cameras in the right spot and physically chasing the runners up and down the mountain to the best of my ability. Basically just trying to push those boundaries of where people have taken cameras to try to give a new insight into what it actually looks like.
Yeah. And so you're in college right now, right?
I am, yeah. I'm a junior at Western Washington University.
And what are you majoring in?
I'll be majoring in environmental science, kind of cultural diversity, sort of film. I find that I'm actually going to college more to learn about the things that I want to film in the future instead of how to film them myself. I find that a lot of the learning, the actual filming experience and learning how to make a film comes from just going out in the field and doing it. college has been really great to kind of show me what is important to me and what I want to film in the future, but the actual experience is what it's all about. And I know Brian didn't, he said he hadn't gone to film school. It seems to have worked out just fine for him, so I'm hoping that I can kind of follow that example.
Yeah, I want to get into that. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking about outdoor filmmaking today with Max Romney, who is a young Alaskan who is in school and is working on a film about the Mount Marathon race, and Brian Smith, National Geographic filmmaker and one of the most accomplished adventure filmmakers around, who's joining us from his studio in British Columbia. Brian, I wonder if you could put yourself back in Max's spot in terms of where you were when you're just starting and when you were sort of looking forward. As he was saying, you didn't go to film school. You sort of learned it along the way. How did that work out? I mean, how did you do that?
Yeah, I mean, it started for me, you know, kind of after college. So, you know, I'd already gone to school and I'd gotten an environmental sciences degree, ironically. And I thought I wanted to be a field biologist, and I kind of started down that path, and it just really wasn't working for me. I was more interested in, you know, taking off and going into the mountains and kayaking. And, you know, filmmaking for me really came from kayaking because I was a professional athlete in the sport, and I knew that wasn't going to last forever. And so I sort of thought, well, I've got all these relationships with the, you know, sponsors. Maybe I can push this idea of filming. And, you know, I definitely, you know, went with that theory as well that, you know, actually experience is probably what's going to teach me the most. And I certainly worked under a lot of people. You know, I took kind of assistant camera positions with some, you know, really talented filmers and, you know, kind of picked their brains and really tried to learn, you know, kind of how they were doing things. And I think, you know, I mean, I don't think that film school is a bad option for people that want to learn the trade. You certainly learn a lot of technical, you know, know-how there, particularly in, like, post-production and, you know, sort of, you know, software and editing techniques. And you can certainly, like, you know, gain a lot from going to film school. But I really do believe in the sort of world of adventure sport that, you know, a lot of the rules don't necessarily completely apply. So you can learn how to use a camera and you can learn how to edit things really well in film school, but it certainly doesn't necessarily teach you, you know, how to put, you know, a several thousand dollar camera between your legs and a kayak and go down a class 5 river. You kind of have to make things up a lot on the fly and actually break a lot of rules of filmmaking to do good stuff in the adventure world. But it, you know, it does come back around. I mean, there are a lot of technical skills and techniques that you need to know, and, you know, you can either learn them if you're an experiential learner like myself, and it sounds like Max. I mean, that's just how I learn, by putting my hands on things and doing stuff. Other people learn by, you know, seeing it in books and you know, getting that real technical influx of information. And so, but I do think if, you know, if you want to do adventure filmmaking, school's only one step of it, because you can learn how to film, but you also need to know how to adventure.
And it seems like that you had that in spades as a kayaker and as a really, you know, fit and daring outdoors person, so that I would think that would be a much bigger asset than sort of the technical skills, because you know how to get out there, you know what's possible, and then you can kind of practice your filmmaking as you're practicing what you really love doing.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, adventure filmmaking or expedition filmmaking, it's not easy. It's like, I always say that, like, to make a good adventure expedition film, you know, there's like a fair amount of suffering that goes into it, because, you know, you've got to be up early and you've got to be ahead of the athletes and you've got to work in these really challenging environments. And I think if you don't already love that or have a passion for it, then, you know, making films in that environment it kind of sucks, you know?
That's right.
And I think that that's a part of it that people don't see from the outside. They see this glamour of, like, oh, I want to make these adventure films. But, you know, if you don't have that adventure coefficient and an ability to kind of suck it up and suffer in these places, then it's really hard, you know? And you definitely need both skill sets. Like, you need to be able to know how to use a camera. and make a film, but you also need to know how to actually exist in, you know, the mountains or the river or, you know, whatever the discipline is that you're choosing to film.
And I want to add another element here and just hear what both of you guys have to say to it. It seems to me like the good outdoor films I see also have a story or some kind of sense of narrative through line from one place to another, and that the ones that don't can be compelling just because they have amazing images, but they don't really hold you. And I'm thinking about some, you know, Warren Miller ski films are fun to watch, but I kind of think of them as being kind of outdoor porn because you see, you know, there's the amazing stunts and then there's sort of like a non-skiing portion, which is kind of like might maybe hokey and sort of get tired of that. And then it comes back in some more amazing stunts, but there's really no, you could sort of drop in at any point in the movie and watch it and then turn it off and it wouldn't really matter. Whereas it seems like a movie that really holds you and sticks with you, there's more like a, you say, there's an expedition and there's sort of the sense of the people there and their energy and how they feel about it. And I'm interested in your sense about that, Brian, about the storytelling aspect. Do you need to think about, you know, where you're going with the film rather than just capturing moments?
Yeah, well, I mean, the story is king in making films. It's the most important thing. I mean, you can have a crappy camera and a great story, and you can make a compelling piece that people will watch. And I think, you know, for me and Real Water Productions, we've definitely gone down the road of storytelling, and we specialize in longer form documentaries that are very much story driven and have through lines and narratives that, you know, takes any audience on a journey. If you're making stuff for National Geographic, then, you know, you're making stuff for a general audience. And I think the reason why you see a lot of, you know, adventure porn pieces, so to speak, is that, you know, there actually is a really good market for that stuff because, you know, a lot of production companies will specialize in making ski films or bike films or surfing films. And the reality is that they're making those for bikers and surfers and skiers. And there's nothing wrong with that because there's actually a pretty big audience out there of people who want to just get excited about their particular sport. And so those models actually work pretty well because, you know, like I said, you know, skiers are going to go out and buy the latest ski film or download it off of iTunes, and that drives those production companies' sales, and the industry that, you know, supports them, whether it's biking or skiing, will throw money at those films because it's an advertising avenue for them. So there's really nothing wrong with those films, but they definitely typically don't tell a story, as you said. And I think at the end of the day, you know, whether you like watching Hollywood feature films or adventure films or, you know, documentary, you know, what typically compels people to watch a film or sucks them in is a great story. And, you know, for me personally, that's what I love. I mean, we love trying to find those stories and telling them. So,
yeah. And as you say, that's what brings the interest for the people who are maybe not going to go kayaking down a class 5 rapids, which is probably the vast majority of us. Max, you're making a film about Mount Marathon, and your story is almost built in because every Mount Marathon race is an amazing event. Have you thought about that sort of that through line or that story that you're trying to tell about the race that you filmed?
Hugely so. Yeah, that's actually what we're working on right now is, you know, a lot of just getting the story down because, you know, you don't just find yourself in an adventure. You don't just find yourself running this race. There's a huge amount of, you know, planning and these journeys that everybody has to get there. The race is just a piece of it. And, you know, I think that's something a lot of people can relate to. And I find that that's the interesting part. In this film specifically, we're following about six different athletes. And they all have these just incredible stories, which just makes this race all the more important and kind of meaningful. You know, you have Holly Brooks, who's an Olympian, two-time winner, and, you know, huge factor, but she hasn't run the race before. And then she's going against Christy Marvin, who won last year, full-time mom of three, has to train kind of around the schedule of, you know, raising three little boys, versus Najeevi, who's a first-time rookie, and then Denali, who grew up on the mountain but kind of lost her way, and, you know, Ricky and Matt and Eric, and it's just all these incredible stories kind of built into one. And it's kind of funny, but I kind of lose track of the race itself. itself. And it's like, oh, yeah, there's all these incredible stories, and they happen on a pretty exciting platform. But, yeah, I mean, it's being able to relate to the people going through these amazing things is what really matters to me, is that I want to make a video that people can see themselves in and see themselves kind of progressing through, whether they relate to Holly or Christy or Denali. I want them to be able to see themselves in this film and really come away from that inspired and changed. Mm-hmm. And that's where the stories come into the film for me.
Did you recognize that before you got started, that you needed to really have a good feel for these characters going into the project before you set up your 17 cameras on the mountain? Or is it more of a learning process as you went along?
Yeah, I think it was very much a learning process. And I'm interested to hear Brian's take on this. I was hoping that it would be a little more organized, but I went in with the idea of kind of film the best video I could with the best quality and kind of take the story as it comes. And what I found was this just incredible story of, for the most part, four really strong women. In a sport that rarely recognizes the women as much as the men, because the men do run faster. That there's all these women working just as hard for longer than a lot of these men and doing really incredible things. And that there's a lot of aspects in this film, but that's one that really kind of resonated with me and something that I only really picked up after about the first interview. And so that kind of changed a little bit of the focus, but that'll be a huge part of it. And it really did shift. It shifted as the race progressed for me.
And then you had to go back and make sure you had the right footage, that it was already that you'd captured those individuals on the mountain.
Yeah, we shot with a pretty wide lens. You really, with a mountain this steep, you can't follow them in a lead car or chase them up. You really have to kind of put the cameras and make sure you capture everything, because anything can happen on a race like this. It doesn't matter if you're the fastest or the strongest. If you face plant and just kind of slide down the mountain face first for a little while, which happens, you're out of the running. And so we really wanted to make sure that we had the whole mountain covered. We were actually hoping to use drones for some of it, just the little DJI quadcopters. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. Seward and the FAA weren't too keen on that, so we respected their wishes and avoided that. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting ways that we had to go around to try to capture every moment.
And I want to get into that a little bit later about some of the sort of challenges of capturing these shots. But Brian, tell me about your process of developing a film in terms of who it's going to be about and what the story is going to be. Does the story come into focus before you start filming, or is it something that you kind of pick up as you're going along and recognizing, like Max is talking about, that he didn't really know what the story was going to be until after he'd really gotten pretty far into it?
Well, I think sometimes it's a little bit of both. I mean, for where we're at now, like in order for us to get the green light on some of these bigger projects, you have to have a fairly solid storyline in place, before you go into it. I mean, of course, you don't know exactly what's going to happen, but you've at least identified some of the story beats and the arc of the story in kind of an ideal world. And central to all this is always a great protagonist or protagonist, plural. Characters drive good films. And so, I think in Max's case, it's like, he set off, thinking, okay, I'm going to make a story about this race, and then pretty quickly realized, okay, wait a second, this is about people, which is so true, because, I mean, when you make a film, you're making it for other people. So what they resonate with is characters, and you need those characters to tell the story in documentary, because, I mean, you're the filmmaker, you're the one that's making the story, but you need voices, and you need authentic voices and compelling people to help bring your audience closer to the story. So, I mean, very early on in our process of trying to figure out, what a film is going to be, is identifying the character, the characters, and going, these guys are going to be great, or these women are going to be great, and they definitely have the authenticity and the personal story that, we think is going to be interesting to an audience. So for us, we start very early in the process of pitching and storyboarding and developing that. But then I think anytime you make documentary, you have to go out into the field with kind of an open eye of where the story could go. And so there's a lot of unexpected that's going to crop up no matter how well you've storyboarded your film out. And you know, like Max, I mean, sometimes the story goes in a direction that you never thought it was going to go. And you have to be able to think on your feet and recognize when that's happening and go, this is good. Like, this is it. You know, let's run with this.
Yeah, it really sounds like a fascinating job, much more than just the outdoor aspect, but sort of the there's a lot to it that sounds really fun, really interesting, and really challenging. And in the second half of the show, we're gonna learn much more. I want to talk with our two guests about the technology they use and how that technology has changed. We may get some tips about how listeners could do a better job of documenting their own exploits, and then also some of the ethical issues and the challenges that we see in filmmaking today. As we, you know, the whole reality filmmaking, so-called reality television that has affected Alaska so much, and also the sort of the daredevil aspect of it. There's a lot to talk about on the topic of outdoor filmmaking. So stick with us in the second half as we'll be talking more with Max Romney, a local who is, I think, going to make good as a filmmaker because I've seen some of his stuff, but he's just getting started. And Brian Smith, who is a National Geographic filmmaker and very well known and done some amazing work. So we're going to continue with that discussion. But first, we're going to take a break. A National Geographic photographer, Paul Nicklin, has traveled to some of the most remote regions of the globe to document the effects of climate change. He worked as a biologist in Alaska before becoming a professional photographer for National Geographic. In October, he returned to Alaska and caught up with APRN's Lori Townsend to talk about where life behind the lens has taken him. I'm Charles Wolforth. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
Paul, tell me about some of your most memorable photography expeditions in the Arctic. What stands out?
I've had so many incredible journeys. I mean, when I look at my images, people say, what's your favorite photo? Well, I don't really ever have a favorite photo. I have favorite moments that will stay with me forever. You know, on my deathbed, it's going to be not surrounded by covers of National Geographic, but it's going to be memories and hopefully friends and family. You know, for myself, for, you know, swimming with narwhals to find out that there really are these unicorns of the sea, and very few people have seen them. And it took me 10 years to get in a position that I could actually photograph them. It involved me buying an ultralight float airplane that I could fly off the sea ice. We flew 100 miles offshore, landed on a floating pan of ice. We were surrounded by 1,000 narwhals. Scenes that nobody else could even dream of or imagine. That scenes that very few people besides the Inuit will ever get a chance to see.
You have also photographed in Antarctica. Tell us about your encounter with a female leopard seal there.
I'm always trying to dispel myths with my photography. It drives me crazy when I go into a bookstore in Alaska and it's like Death by Bear and Alaska Tales of Death, and every picture's got a bear on the cover that's, you know, snarling, and bears don't even growl like that. You know, maybe it's yawning, or maybe a trainer's making it yawn. Person takes a picture, and, you know, so that stuff just really irks me. And so I'm always, these animals need a fair shake. I mean, these animals are just trying to survive. And so to have, you know, leopard seals be, you know, the villain in 8 Below Zero and Happy Feet, and it's just this vicious monster. And I don't think any animal is vicious. We have to change how we perceive and how we connect with these species and ecosystems. And if I want people to care about ice, I can't afford to have them thinking, oh, Antarctica, ice, oh, that's where those terrible monsters live. You know, I pitched a story to Geographic to go to Antarctica and get in the water with as many leopard seals as I could over a 6-week period, just to see if they were vicious or if they were misunderstood. And I was amazed. I mean, I was nervous jumping in the water this first day with a 1,000-pound female leopard seal that had just killed the penguin, and there's blood and guts in the water, and she was ramming the dead penguin under the hull of our little Zodiac. We're trying not to fall in the water. And that's when I had to get in. So I put my snorkel in my mouth, my mask, and my dry suit and weight belt, and jumped in the water. And right away, this 1,000-pound seal that's, you know, a head bigger than a grizzly bear's, you know, came shooting over to me, engulfed my entire head in her mouth in this big cobra-like threat display. And she kept doing these threat display lunges at me. But it never looked aggressive. It was kind of, if you look at a leopard seal, they have no scars on their body. So I think they're always communicating with these displays. And so she calmed down after 5 minutes, and then she went off and got a penguin and tried to feed me the penguin, and a live one. And then she realized I couldn't catch that. So she brought me tired penguins, nearly dead penguins, and she brought me dead penguins. At one point I had 5 dead penguins floating around my head. She started to flip penguins onto my head. She defended me from other leopard seals when they came by. And she would come and sleep by my sailboat at night, and then in the morning when I'd go back out into the Zodiac, she'd be there waiting for us like a big excited puppy dog. We'd drive over to wherever we wanted to photograph her next to icebergs. She'd go off and get a penguin, and we'd do this song and dance. And this went on for 4 days before she finally realized that I wasn't going to eat a penguin. And I went from being terrified to laughing so hard and crying in my mask. It was tears of joy and water flooding in my mask. I was constantly clearing my mask, trying to just see this amazing thing going on in front of me. So it's something I'll definitely never forget.
You were adopted by a leopard seal.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, again, you can be anthropomorphic or anthropocentric on these types of encounters, but I really think that in her eyes, she was just trying to figure out what I was doing there. She'd probably never seen a human being before, and so, I mean, you're either breeding or you're feeding. And so she thought, if she could just get me to accept a penguin, she would understand why I was there. And then I think it became such this urgent need to make sure I wasn't going to starve. You know, she was, all of a sudden, I think she went from figuring out what I was to trying to help me. You know, you don't want to be anthropomorphic about this stuff, but I don't know how else to think about it.
What are you or do you really hope to accomplish with the pictures that you take?
Everybody has a role to play. The scientists, I mean, without science, my pictures don't mean a lot. They're more of my own emotional interpretation. But I think since the beginning of time, since the time of drawing paintings on cave walls, we are visual storytellers. You think of the Inuit culture, it's very visual, very creative, very artistic. I think that we've been beating people over the head with facts of climate change in the newspapers. You read about it every day. I think we become inundated with it, and I think we become numb to it. So I'm just using my photographs as constant reminders, and we are seeing a shift in people's perceptions about the change. Not only am I trying to inspire change, but I'm also trying to drive change with decision makers and influential people.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about outdoor filmmaking, and we have two guests with us on the line. Filmmaker Max Romney is just getting started. He's an Alaskan. He's a junior in college, and he's working on a film about Mount Marathon. And Brian Smith is what you might say is living the filmmaker's dream. He's got a fantastic career going, making films for National Geographic, some incredibly spectacular adventure and expedition filmmaking. And is sort of the someone who knows a lot about this and can really give us some insight on what it's like on the larger stage. Brian, I'm interested if technology has changed the way you do your work. Or if that's only sort of at the lower end. You know, I know I when GoPro cameras came out, you started to see lots of images that people would make on their own outdoor adventures, which were pretty good. You know, they look pretty sharp and you can see them all over the internet. But you're sort of at a level where you're doing something that's much more professional. And I don't know if really the technology revolution has affected you that much. How does that play out in your work?
Oh, I mean, it's hugely impacted me in the sense that, when I first came into this, adventure films were still largely being shot on, mini SD tapes. And the advent of digital and HD was just starting to begin to happen. And at that time, high definition cameras were pretty unaffordable. And, obviously we're operating at a higher level, but, just like the consumer level cameras have gotten better and come down in price. I mean, the same thing has happened at the high level. We pretty much now shoot exclusively on RED digital cinema cameras, and that's the same camera system that Peter Jackson just shot The Hobbit with. So at the same time, the consumer level stuff has become, you know, really democratized in the sense that, you know, anyone can get their hands on it. So has the professional equipment, because, you know, now we have cameras that are shooting in 6K resolution, and, you know, we're acquiring footage at the absolute highest level that's possible. And that camera system, you know, only costs, you know, aside from lenses and stuff, somewhere around $35,000, which seems like a lot of money for sure. But the equivalent of that 10 years ago when I got started, you know, you had to spend $250,000 to play the game of, you know, Hollywood cinema. Mm-hmm. So it's really flipped it on its head in the sense that, you know, technology means that, you know, the acquisition of these super high-end images is not actually in the money side of it anymore. Like, you don't just have to be extremely wealthy or some well-off, you know, production company in LA. You just need to have good ideas.
I think everybody would agree that outdoor filmmaking has gone through this amazing renaissance where what we're seeing is like we wouldn't even have dreamed of seeing, you know, 10 years ago. And every year it seems to get more extraordinary. Do you think that technology is a really big part of that, or is there something else happening too?
Well, I think technology is a huge part of it in the sense that, you know, I mean, with, you know, the advent of certain cameras and as cameras get smaller and better quality, you know, you get closer to seeing what the human eye sees. You know, you're starting to get these incredibly vivid images and colors and cameras that work really well in low light situations. Story still is really important. And so I think, you know, adventure filmmakers are getting better at telling stories simultaneously. So, you know, the combination of having, you know, really great cameras at their fingertips, and then, I think just like these sports, you know, adventure filmmaking evolves, you know, it started somewhere and, you know, people every year are trying to one up whatever happened the year before. So, you know, you have an evolution of technology, but you also have an evolution of the filmmakers themselves.
Yeah. And watching some of the kind of making of video of yours that I saw, you know, you're roping up, you're putting cameras on ropes above canyons, and you're doing some pretty challenging, difficult stuff just to get these images, which I'm sure, do you feel pushed by the competition when you're doing that stuff, or is it more just like you've got an image in your mind that you want to capture, and that's how you have to do it?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, we pay very close attention to what everyone else is doing. You know, we watch films, and I think everyone is, you know, in this business, there's a competition in the sense that, you know, to be on the top of the game and to be able to command bigger contracts, you have to be doing stuff that people feel is cutting edge. And so, you know, when you see people doing stuff, you think, well, how could we do that? Or how could we do that differently or better? So I think, you know, there's definitely that. But, you know, really at the end of the day, like a lot of where it starts for us is not, oh, what's someone else doing and how can we do it better? But what's our story? And how do we capture the image, you know? And sometimes that takes a lot of thinking and ingenuity of, you know, where you're going to put cameras or, you know, does the camera have to be moving or flying or following the object? You know, do you use helicopters? Do you use drones? And so there's all these tools available to you. And even though there's a competition going on, really the fundamental is like, how do you capture that image? How do you convey the story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's in service of something, right? Max, you know, if you had started a few years earlier, you would not have been able to deploy 17 cameras on Marathon to do your first, longer film, because it simply wouldn't have been technically affordable or possible. It still sounds pretty challenging to go out and find 17 cameras. Tell us about some of the challenges you faced as a young filmmaker in putting all this together. I know it's not cheap, and you had a fundraising campaign online as well to make it happen, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, just to start, the 17 cameras were attached to 13 people, so that was a pretty big part of getting those up on the mountain. As you know, it wasn't just like placing still cameras. I had a huge amount of help just from the community. A lot of these mountain runners are really passionate about the sport, and this is the kind of video that nobody's been able to see before, and I've had a lot of help that, you know, I really couldn't do it without the kind of help that I have had to make this possible. But yeah, I mean, just the camera revolution has been insane. And I'm kind of on the ghetto side of the camera spectrum. I definitely don't have a whole lot of money as a college student. You know, I'm not looking at being able to afford very nice cameras, but what's kind of nice is the price is just every year it's getting lower and lower for nicer stuff. So I've been working a lot with DSLRs and GoPros. Mm-hmm. To do everything I can. And I'd say, like, the first thing that a lot of people need to realize, and I'd be speaking to Alaskans here especially, is that you can take, you know, a disposable camera, walk a mile in any direction, and take a picture blindfolded, and it's going to turn out good. You know, shooting in a beautiful location like Alaska or British Columbia or Bellingham, you've gotten a lot of the work done for you, and then after that, it's just a matter of, you know, you're choosing your stylistic choices, like what cameras you want, but the options right now are just absolutely incredible.
So, and I also noticed you got really lucky in that the day of the race you filmed, it was a beautiful bluebird day in Seward, which is not something that comes across the clog every year, right?
Yeah, lucky for me, unlucky for the runners. The heat was actually a pretty big deal. I think it was about 70 degrees, but when you're running up and down a mountain, that was a pretty big problem for
right.
a lot of people. But yeah, Brian nailed it earlier when he said that sometimes it's the worst weather that makes for the most exciting pictures and kind of story. And what's kind of nice, especially with, you know, the GoPros and a lot of these much more rugged cameras, is that they can handle that. I've dropped multiple cameras doing things that other cameras, you know, could not handle, and they're getting to the point where they can start to handle the outdoor lifestyle that I want them to be filming.
So how much is your film going to cost from beginning to end, Max, if you don't mind telling us round numbers?
Kind of scary to say out loud, but in total, from beginning to end, including film festival entry fees, we've calculated that it could cost somewhere between $60,000 and $80,000.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that has already been covered. The hard part has basically been covered, in that we have the footage, which is really great. But hours wise, I've heard somewhere that a minute of film often takes between 6 to 10 hours to create. But for this kind of video, a 30-minute film, already we've put about 600 hours into just creating it, and it's probably going to take double or triple that to bring it to its full finished form. So a lot of that is just getting the money to be able to support that. And luckily for me, the community is really backing me up on this. We ran a Kickstarter-like crowdfunding campaign. It was actually on Indiegogo, but we raised over $8,000 already, which has really helped pay for a lot of the labor. The co-producer that I'm working with, Natalie Fedak, was working at Disneyland, and now because of the amount of money we raised, she can now work on this project full-time. And then a lot of the other costs are going to go into funding just the music rights, and, I mean, stuff like this is very expensive, but what's wonderful is that we have the footage, and that's really the important part, is the footage and the story is in our grasp, and now it's just a point of making the story polished enough to be able to share on a lot of these large formats like film festivals and be able to get this pretty inspirational story all over the world.
Mm-hmm. And you're not really trying to make your money back on this, right? I mean, it's a project that you're getting started as a filmmaker, or do you hope to actually, you know, make a profit on it?
Brian could probably talk more about this, but you don't go into filmmaking with the idea of making a lot of money, I think. I hope I'm working so that I'm not in the red. I am not in a lot of debt right now. I mean, as a college student, that's something that's really important to me, is to make sure that I don't put myself in too much financial debt, especially because the freedom to be able to make the kind of films that I want to make, not have to make the films that will make me money, is really important to me. It's been really exciting to see what kind of support that the Alaskan community has already given to this project. It's really kind of given me a huge boost of inspiration. But yeah, I mean, it's an expensive process, just making the money would only come on the back end when selling DVDs and stuff. And we're actually trying to work a little bit differently. We're going to be creating T-shirts, with 100% of the profits are going to go straight into the project. We have stickers for sale on the website. And so we're kind of going the back end and trying to avoid a lot of the, you know, the big things that could really push this project in one direction, because we do want it to be for the runners. We want it to be for the people who actually do the race, not for, you know, a shoe company or something that can afford to give us a lot of money for some good PR.
Right, right. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and that's Max Romney, an up-and-coming Alaskan filmmaker, and Brian Smith is with me as well. He's a National Geographic filmmaker. Max is in Bellingham. Brian is in British Columbia at his studio. Brian, give us a ballpark of outdoor movie costs, you know, when you're working with sort of a major kind of funder. I mean, I really don't have any idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit all over the map, but, you know, I think if you take like a, you know, the format that we work in a lot of times is the 1 hour, feature doc realm, which would, you know, be a 1 hour slot on television or, you know, at film festivals or what have you. And, in that sort of category, you know, it could range anywhere from, say, you know, $200,000 to, you know, $1 million, depending on what kind of production, you know, tools are implied. And then also the thing I think about the bigger productions that people forget about is, you know, it's some of the stuff that Max mentioned, but, you know, I mean, there's an insane process of, you know, audio post-production, color correction, music rights. And then on top of that, you know, there's the budget to actually just make the film. But then there's also the distribution budget, which is something that we don't handle a lot. But, you know, if National Geographic puts $250,000 into the actual production of the film, you know, it might cost them, you know, $500,000 in the end by the time you look at, you know, all the amount of money they're paying for on-air time and executives and, you know, the infrastructure that they actually are supporting on their end. So, you know, it's all over the place. I mean, it you know, some stuff's done really cheaply. Some you know, great adventure documentaries are acquired and then put together on the back end. So, you know, the footage is actually captured relatively lo-fi and cheaply. And then, you know, I mean, we just finished a one-hour documentary where we followed Will Gadd and Gavin McClurg traversing the Canadian Rockies, you know, 800 kilometers by paraglider. And the only way to cover that story is with a helicopter. And so, you know, you look at it and you go, well, that's a huge budget. But, you know, the majority of the budget went into, you know, funding an A-Star for 3.5 weeks.
Wow. Yeah, really. That is expensive. So
yeah. So, you know, you see all of a sudden you see the dollar ticker just like go through the roof, you know? Mm-hmm. So a lot of it depends on, you know, not just like, oh, you put more money into a film and it's a better film. A lot of times it's, you know, sometimes expensive films are expensive because there's really no other way to do it. You know, it actually costs that amount of money depending on the location you're shooting in or the tools that you need to actually capture the story.
Yeah. So with all the money on the line and then also the competition you talked about in terms of watching other filmmakers do their thing, there's a obviously a tendency on some filmmakers' part to sort of push the limits in terms of stunts and really dangerous activities. And, you know, especially in the ski film, so many people have lost their lives. I'm wondering how you address that issue, Brian, if you ever feel like you're being pushed or you have the need to film some more and more dangerous or more and more spectacular stuff just to keep up with others. And it sometimes maybe this isn't the right thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be willing to say no. You also like, I mean, we work like, these are relationships you develop with the athletes that you're working with. You know, it's like, you know, when you enter into a big project, you know, sometimes people look at it and they go, oh, well, there's this guy that's doing these stunts and then there's the film crew. But, you know, really we're kind of one big family out there and everyone's working together. And I think there's a pretty intimate relationship that starts to develop between like the director or filmmaker and the, you know, the talent or the athletes or protagonists that you're working with. And I think, you know, I think the bigger part of that story is that, you know, everyone's going to say on, you know, like on face value, everyone's going to be like, well, you know, it's always more important to walk away at the end of the day and live. But there's still pressure that, you know, trickles down through everyone. There's pressure on us to deliver a film. I mean, of course, we're going to be willing to come back to National Geographic and say, well, we didn't get it because it got too unsafe. And National Geographic and other companies we work for are always going to put safety out as the number one priority. You know, like, that's always talked about. Like, you know, if you guys don't feel good about this or, you know, feels unsafe, well, then just say no. But that doesn't take away from the fact that there's still a pressure to produce, mm-hmm. you know? And I think the athletes will say the same thing. I mean, you know, are they going to do stuff just for the camera? No, but their career is also supported by being successful. You know, if a certain athlete, you know, makes it on to, you know, a 1-hour documentary on the National Geographic Channel and it's really successful, like, that furthers their career. So I think the real pressure is on us in the field to produce something amazing. And there's no real big picture way to look at it. I mean, these are things that are evaluated on a day-to-day and a moment-to-moment level. And so I think for Real Water Productions and the crew of people that I work with, you know, we're constantly, you know, evaluating, and sometimes things change and you go, well, it's just too sketchy. Like, we need more time, you know, like, we can't do it right now. We need an extra week of filming, and we have to go back and say, you know, it's unsafe. The weather's, you know, crappy. It's not going to happen, or we can't push this. Like, you know, we need more time to do this. And so these are just, like, you know, constant evaluations that are happening. And, but I would lie, I think, to say that there isn't, you know, pressure on everyone to make it happen.
But it sounds like what you're trying different. To do with your films is you're really trying to demonstrate something that's real. And you're really trying to sort of document something. And it's not like a lot of these films are being made about Alaska that are really just sort of, you know, made up, you know, garbage. I mean, just to put it frankly. You're actually trying.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, reality is a real part of what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, we want the real story. We want the struggle. We want the failure, and then hopefully we want success or payoff on the end. And you know what you're seeing a lot, and the whole what you guys see up there in Alaska. I mean, we laugh at it all the time because what you're seeing is manufactured television in the sense that, you know, it's a created story arc. It's like, okay, well, let's manufacture the drama because every good story needs drama and success.
Right, so, and so they just push it,
know,
yeah, push it into the absurd.
Because if we can manufacture it, we can do it a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. You know, if that guy just gets mad and yells at the other guy, there's our drama, and everything's produced.
Yeah.
And so, I mean,
and we're going to have to leave it at that. I want to thank both of my guests, and I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Brian. A topic that could have gone much longer than an hour, but we had two great guests, Brian Smith, who has been making films with National Geographic and many other clients. His website is linked at alaskapublic.org on today's show, and Max Romney, who's working on a show about the Mount Marathon race, and you can find his work at alaskapublic.org as well. Next week, as the shortest day of the year approaches, we'll hear from three astronomers about stargazing in Alaska, a professional, a teacher, and an outdoor adventurer who's an amateur sky photographer. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Grace Bojean is our production assistant. Monica Goki is our producer. And I'm your host, Charles Woolforth. And I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.